Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith. Music there from Peter Mwanga from Malawi, a country bordered by Zambia to the northwest, Tanzania to the northeast, and Mozambique to the east, south and west, and the birthplace of Elly Kasumbe, one of the founders of Our Table. Well, I'll be talking with Elly shortly about her time in direct provision here in Ireland and how she now uses her passion for food and cooking to draw attention to the reality of direct provision. But first, this Sunday evening on RTE1 television at 8 o'clock, you can see Jesus Countdown to Calvary, already called by the American press a landmark documentary, which uses the production values, narrative tools and pace of a political thriller to retell the story of the last 6 days of Jesus' life. It's presented by Hugh Bonneville of Downton Abbey, who you might know also studied theology in Cambridge.
Tradition has it that in a tomb like this, the body of a Jewish healer and preacher from Nazareth, called Jesus, was laid to rest in about 30 AD, nearly 2,000 years ago. Whether you are a person of faith or of none, you cannot escape the fact that the last 6 days of this man's life and his death changed the world. I'm not going to chart the religion that grew out of these events. I'm interested in the events themselves. What happened in that final week of Jesus's life? How he died, why he died, and who killed him.
Hugh Bonneville there from Jesus Countdown to Calvary, which is a co-production by RTE with ARTE and American Public Television. And we have the programme's director, Jerry Hoban, with us, also producer of Who Do You Think You Are? And one of the programme's contributors, Dr. Zalika Rogers, lecturer in Jewish Studies in Trinity College, also with us in the studio this afternoon. Jerry, for you as a director, this is a story that's been told many times before. At the planning meetings, how did you decide on the approach you were going to take?
I think you're absolutely right. There are so many slightly hokey, slightly cheesy, slightly papyrusy versions of the Jesus story. The original starting point was to see it not as a faith program, but as a history program. To see it as Jerusalem, as the Washington DC or the London of its day, with the Jewish high priests, with the Roman occupiers, in the middle of a week of temperament and energy, because Passover is a celebration of independence and freedom. And into this walks this itinerant preacher and the kind of tinderbox he was walking into or he was creating. So the fact that it was a non-faith program, that it was a forensically historical political program, appealed to me as somebody of small amount of faith. And it appealed to Hugh, I know, because he knew it would reach a broader audience. There's no point in corralling your story just for people of devout faith. That this is actually, there is no way you cannot accept that those 6 days, those last 6 days in Jesus' life and his death, are six of the most momentous days in history, for everything that happened afterwards. And it was very important for me and Hugh, because Hugh has said in interviews before, he went into his theology degree in Cambridge, went in an atheist and came out an agnostic. So we didn't want to upset those of faith, but at the same time, we didn't want to alienate those of no faith. So the very first decision in the production meeting was, this program ends in the tomb.
Zalika Rogers is also with us on the programme this afternoon. Zalika, when we start to look at the story and, you know, up to 500 crucifixions in one day, why would one man's crucifixion last beyond that particular story? What was happening that gave the story traction?
Well, I think it's due to the genius of the early Christians. And I don't think that we can underestimate the importance of the creativity of that Paul and the gospel writers brought to that story. It's not just transmitted, it's interpreted. And it's interpreted in terms of their faith experience, their belief in Jesus Christ's resurrection. And I think that that is the strength. That's how it's lasted. It's because these extraordinarily creative people who were inspired by this faith experience, retold the story in such a way that captured people's imagination. And also, they must have experienced something of that themselves.
Jerry, where do you see Judas and his story unfolding as you're directing this programme?
The role of Judas is subject to a fair amount of revisionism in general. But a lot of this boils down to what Hugh might call fake news. And that was, again, going back to your original question about what their original production meeting was about, what we wanted to do editorially. And Hugh, being a public figure who's written about in the tabloids himself, I'm sure quite a lot, is very aware that every story has an agenda. And this idea of fake news and just putting a spin on the news. And that's and we do an analysis of both the writing of the Gospels and the role of Judas in the context of what's the message that's trying to come across. And you've got to remember that the Gospels were written to proselytize, to preach in the Roman Empire. And they didn't want to annoy the Roman masters. And to an extent, there's a dramatic license of good guy and bad guy. And so therefore, Pontius Pilate is set out to be a little bit more wavering, that it's the Jewish mob who put pressure on him to make the decisions he does. Equally with the role of Judas, we go into slightly nerdish, if you're a history or a language geek, analysis of the word paradidomi, which is the original Greek version of the gospel, the definition of the word betray. It's used 40 plus times, I think, in four gospels about Judas. But actually, its basic meaning is to hand over. And so therefore, there is a discussion amongst many learned people, Zuleika included, about the role of Judas, whether he was in cahoots with Jesus as part of an end game. If you see the death of Jesus as something that he was trying to incite himself, that he felt it was his end game, that Judas was in cahoots, he wasn't betraying him. And that, to me, started to open up an entirely new political interpretation of the man, as opposed to 2,000 years of anti-Semitism, which is the way he's been betrayed. And Zuleika's input into that, because we filmed in the field where technically Judas hanged himself after taking his pieces of silver.
I'd like to pick up on something that Jerry was talking about, and that is about the issue of the interpretation, the later interpretation of Judas and the in the Gospels, but not just of Judas, also of the Jewish mob, and also of Caiaphas, the high priest in the Jewish aristocracy as well. Jerry had mentioned that, of course, the Gospels are being written in the latter part of the first century in the context of the Roman Empire. But what the Gospel writers are also doing is that they are trying to claim the inheritance of Israel themselves. They are the true Israel over against those who have not followed Jesus. The problem is that it is set up in a way as good guy, bad guy. When later readers come to look at these texts, they don't see the use of ancient rhetoric and portrayal, the vilification of this group, nor do they see that on the other side, the early Christians are trying to claim themselves as the true Israel. So the problem is that from the early church fathers onwards, from Melito of Sardis, for example, in the second century onwards, we have the interpretation of the Jews as those who are responsible for the death of Jesus. And so we have this Christ killer myth. And the two things are conflated. On the one hand, Judas as the betrayer, treachery towards Jesus. And on the other hand, those responsible for the killing of Jesus. And these are brought together throughout history. So the Jews are seen as Christ killers. And this isn't just a type of hatred that remains rhetorical. This is a hatred that takes on an extraordinarily powerful role in Western culture, politics, art. And it's responsible, and I think Amos Oz talks about how it was the Chernobyl of anti-Semitism. But, I mean, he's talking about Judas there, but the idea of the Jews as the Christ killers, this type of hatred was responsible for incredible amounts of violence over the past 2,000 years.
Let's hear from Amos.
I think this particular story is responsible for more bloodshed than any other story in human history. Persecutions, Inquisition, pogroms, Holocaust. In fact, I believe the story in the Gospels is the Chernobyl of Christian anti-Semitism for the last 2,000 years. So the Gospels, especially the story of the betrayal, the story of Judas, They were written in a cold-blooded intention to incite anti-Jewish feelings.
There was an added relevance to us meeting with Amos. There's two things I would say about Amos. One of them was he doesn't give interviews. He's a Nobel laureate in waiting as far as the literary world is concerned. And he doesn't give interviews. He's been a thorn in the side of the Israeli government ever since, you know, the incursions of the 60s. And I made contact with him directly through his agent. Luckily, he's a huge fan of Downton Abbey. When he heard that Hugh Bonneville was presenting, he said yes immediately. And when we got there, he and his wife had the Downton Abbey DVD out to be signed by Hugh. And he gave us that amazing interview that you've just heard. His central thesis, his most recent novel, is a novel called Judas. It's not historical, but his central thesis is that without Judas, we would have no Christianity. When you're in this small old city of Jerusalem, you realise how important it is that 3 o'clock every Friday, not just Good Friday, people gather at the base of the Antonia Fortress to start the Via Dolorosa. And you cannot mess with that faith. What I find, and there's a clip near the end of the programme where Father Gregory Tatum is talking about the grim, visceral reality of crucifixion versus the slightly shinier and cleaner middle-aged ladies of a certain age walking the Via Dolorosa. And we intercut between the result of that death 2,000 years later and the fate that rose out of it, and the treatment of him as a common bandit. There's another clip with Hugh in a taxi coming back from Gethsemane where three of the Gospels, I think, say, he says to them, "Are you treating me like a common bandit?" And again, with the forensic legal side of things, there was only one punishment for banditry, and that was crucifixion. So if they were going to kill the man, they needed to accuse him not of being the Messiah. They needed to accuse him of just being a bandit or of banditry. And so that brings it all to life.
Jesus doesn't seem to have been killed for his message. He seems to have been killed because of the possibility of bringing political instability and unrest into the city during Passover. His followers are not killed. And social banditry, we know, is a common phenomenon in the first century in Palestine.
The CCTV cameras, the armed presence in the city, is a very good metaphor for what was happening there as well and the tensions that were happening there. It's a beautiful city, but it is a little bit depressing to be so close to three of the holiest places in religion. You know, the Western Wall for Judaism, the Al-Aqsa Mosque for Islam, and then 100 yards, 150 yards away, you've got the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is traditionally where Golgotha was, where Jesus died and was buried. And so it's meant to be one of the most spiritual places on earth, and yet there's an armed presence everywhere you go. There's a tension everywhere you go. You see these young Israeli cadets leaning their submachine guns up against the wall before they go and pray at the Western Wall. It's anachronistic, I suppose, is the word, that you're in such a holy place, surrounded by so much bad will, for want of a better word.
I think that one of my former professors used to say that about the Holy Sepulchre, but I think you could say it about Jerusalem as well. While you go there and you're expecting this spiritual experience, you know, these three religions holding this as their holy city, and you have this expectation that it's all going to be calm and serene and spiritual. And he always pointed it out to us as students that actually what made it so interesting is that it's the most human. We see people behaving in, you know, as passionate human beings. And I think that's what also is important to say about Jerusalem as well.
Fair point.
Dr. Zalika Rogers and Jerry Hoban, who's the director of Jesus Countdown to Calvary, which you can see on RTE One television this Easter Sunday at 8 o'clock. Let's see the final word with Hugh.
Now, whether you think he was a political agitator, a religious reformer, an idealist in the wrong place at the wrong time, or the Son of God fulfilling his destiny, the simple fact is he was crucified by the Romans. But for his followers, salvation was at hand, because his death was just the beginning.
And you can see that programme on RTE One television this Sunday evening at 8. And a quick reminder that at 3 o'clock this afternoon on RTE Radio 1 Extra on 252 Longwave and on Serviu and Digital Radio, you can hear the solemn liturgy for Good Friday in a broadcast shared with RTE One television. The Liturgy of the Passion of the Lord comes from the Church of the Annunciation in Clonard County, Wexford. For the last 5 weeks at Christchurch Cathedral in Dublin, there's been a pop-up cafe on the grounds of the church run by a group called Our Table. I met with one of the group's founders.
I moved over here many years back to seek asylum.
That's Ellie Kasombe.
I've travelled quite before, and I was really lucky that I was born in a very privileged family, that our parents gave us like that good life, and I visited some countries near Ireland. But to be honest, I never knew that there is a Republic of Ireland.
What were you fleeing?
I was fleeing persecution. You know, I'm a young activist, and I'm also born from a generation of politicians. My parents themselves, they were involved in politics. My parents, both of them, they died, which we believe that my father, something really bad happened to him. And my uncle was also, you know, a big politician who he heads like the opposition party. And something really, really bad happened to him again. He was taken away from us. So, you know, like all these things built an anger to me that then I become a rebel. And then I started like, you know, going after the government. So maybe you heard like in 2009, 2008 in Malawi, there was a state of emergency where students like we organized protests and things like that and to go after the red president. So at that time, there were a lot of things that really happened that even a lot of big names were involved that, you know, the big names with big power that they can silence you very easily. And, you know, so those are some of the reasons that made me.
What did you leave behind?
I left my children and my family, my sisters. And at some point, you have to understand that my parents were dead. And there is also family politics, you know, and you also becoming like trouble. So you are becoming like a liberal, like, okay, this we've already have enough problems, and she wants to get us more problems. So even part of the family, some of them, they don't even want to be associated with you because, you know, they just don't want that trouble. Everyone just want to live in peace. So I couldn't take it, and I couldn't even live in Malawi because I don't think I could have been here as I'm speaking to you.
When have you last seen your children?
Fortunately now, they all joined me later after I arrived here, but I stayed over 5 years without seeing my children here in Ireland. Yeah.
So you were in direct provision.
Yeah.
And you found yourself in very many different parts of Ireland.
Yeah, exactly.
What were you able to do while you were in direct provision?
So when I was put into the first direct provision centre, I was really, really bad diagnosed with depression, and it was really hard. At first, I lived in a hostel where I lived with many people from, you know, the countries that they had limited English. And they were really living like prisoners. And, you know, like, that's one of the things that disturbed me, other than being disturbed with what I was going through. So through that, you know, the only thing I could relate to myself was a church, because I'm a Catholic. And I'm a very, very, coming from a very strong Catholic background. So I could go to the church and talk to the sisters, like, why can't you come and help out, teach people English and things like that, and then set up gardens and sit down with people. Try to find things that could take us, like, a day-to-day life. And that time, it was really, really hard. And lucky enough, in 2011, I was really lucky that I got a volunteer job with Irish Refugee Council. So at that time, they needed, like, an asylum seeker who could be in their office and then who could be able to highlight the issues around direct provision. So through then, yeah, I started like volunteering with them. So from there, I was really, really privileged in this hardest situation that I was able to go in a different places, raise awareness, and I proposed like things to the CEO at that time, Sue Conland. So why can we do this? I had full of ideas, you know, like, so why can we do this? Why can we do this? Because like for me, what killed me most is the label of an asylum seeker, because I always believe, and that really makes me feel emotion, because I always feel like anyone, even today, can become asylum or a refugee because of circumstances. So that killed me most. And sometimes when I was being treated really sympathetic or sometimes bad, sometimes being treated like charity, it's good to have charity, but being that type of thing, like, it's a thing, it's not, because there's no dignity there, you know? So being that type of, look yourself as a thing, being degraded, that's what made me most anger from where I'm coming from where I am, and everything was just a disaster in me. Yeah.
Now you've channeled that energy to the point that we're here outside Christchurch Cathedral.
Yeah.
Tell us about what is actually happening here right now today.
Yeah, so through that anger, I tried to channel that anger into a very positive thing by doing things that could liberate me and also helps my fellow asylum seekers, you know. So I was doing a lot of cooking, like with women. And in 2015, there was a business lady who approached my CEO at that time. She's in food business, and she talked to her that, why can I do something to help asylum seekers? I've heard that people are not allowed to cook. So they were like, oh, we know the person you can get in touch with. So they introduced us, and we sit down, and she brought a cake, and we just clicked. So I just said, you know, like, I'm a very good cook. And, you know, I've learned it from my mama, and, you know, like, my mama, that was her thing. So we just took it there. Then we started cooking, and, you know, she's a white Irish woman. She had a privilege, you know, knowing people. So she could take us, like, places, like getting us community kitchens, and we go there, cook, and we invite people to come and try, taste the food. And people are like, this is nice. Why can't you do more? So then we started, like, running up pop-ups. In 2016, we ran a big pop-up, first pop-up in a project art center for 2 days, and we fed a lot of people, over 700 people who walk in and out. So from there, it was, like, from one place to the other, from one place to the other. And then it was, you know, the whole island. And then in 2016, September, October, we launched a pop-up cafe in the project art. It was really, really successful, too, and we had huge support. And then in 2016, and I found myself going to Balimalu, where Darina Allen did invited me, and that was just like another hall of breakthrough. So, yeah, so that was deadly.
So people going past the stand here can actually end up eating Balimalu inspired food.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I have a lot of knowledge of food. What I had and what I add up there is just like Brendan Lilly wear and just make into an explosive. So,
let's walk over to the stand and introduce us to the guys that are there, and maybe tell us a little bit more about what's happening.
So we have here Dorcas. She's one of our pesto chefs. She likes baking, but she's on her way. One day she'll become a pesto chef. So she's a kitchen assistant. She's helping out, but she's a very good baker. And we have Lucas here. Lucas is he's also like one of our sales, but he's also a volunteer driver that sometimes when we have like work, maybe we are driving around island, you know, he helps us out. Maybe we borrow a car and he drives us out. So we have Brian, and Brian is also one of the guys who are really, really working hard for the project, selling and also, you know, waitressing. And we have Tafadzwa. Actually, Tafadzwa, he is a qualified chartered accountant. Yeah. And you know, and this is what we are keeping in direct provision, and this is what we really need to highlight, that, you know, these are people with, you know, with something in them that they can provide to the economy of the country, but leaving them in direct provision does not even sort out any problems. I think it's just not right.
Let's go in and talk to the guys,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah,
and
without, sure, you can,
but
yeah.
Guys, what does it mean for you to actually be involved in a project like this?
For me, actually, it means being able to give back, to showcase my what I can do, and to, you know, help out any way I can, because I know how it feels to be in direct provision. Well, I'm in it directly, and it's an avenue to, you know, to reach out to people and to let them understand that.
How does this affect your dignity?
At least it gives me an idea on to interact with people.
Ellie's rather proud of having a chartered accountant on the team. Do you mean you get to keep an eye on all the figures?
Well, I help around with the figures and here and there, and just keep the books aligned. Yeah. That's what I do personally. Just help out. Yes.
And what has been the impact of our table for you personally?
Well, it gives some sort of hope that maybe if they do look into it, maybe in the future something can happen and we might have a better future here. Yeah. You can just imagine being in a chartered accountant. With Ellie, for example, she's been in direct provision for like 8 years. And you can imagine like me being an accountant, just idle for like 8 years. Who's going to hire you to work for them?
Has that been one of the big challenges, the idleness?
Yes, it has. It has, actually, because you lose a lot of self-esteem, and it's really bad. It's really bad.
What does the future hold for you?
Well, as it is, we don't know. We can't tell because we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
And will or are you allowed to work?
No, we're not allowed to work. So when we get the chance to volunteer, what Ellie is doing is really good. You get to express yourself or exercise your talent, and it helps. Help mentally, it helps a lot. So I really think it's a very good project, yes.
Thank you. Your name again is?
Doria Swander.
Doria.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell me about your cooking now.
The best thing I can ever do. I love cooking and I'm here. I've been given the chance by our director, Ellie. She's giving me the chance to express myself better because cooking is my thing, and I'm so happy to be here. I'm still new in Ireland, but to be honest with you, I'm enjoying every moment. Yes.
What's your story that you found yourself here in Ireland?
Actually, it was some problems that we had in Zimbabwe that made me come here. Yes.
And again, do you have any sense of what the future holds?
I don't know what I'm going to get out of my application to as a refugee here. But in the event that I'm successful, I'll be happy. And I think having known this place, I think it can give me a better platform to be what I want to be in life. Yes.
Ellie, back to why you were here outside Christchurch Cathedral. What was the initiative and how did you find yourself on church property?
Yeah, so in 2016, we closed in a project at, and then I went to Ballymaloe. So when I went to Ballymaloe, when I was coming back, I think the best funding I had was love I got from Darina, that I was able to do, like, because now, that time I was unstoppable. So I was able to do cooking and everything, and you know, like no restrictions on me and things like that. And we have another lady which I knew, which is a health environmental officer, Joanna Troton, who has been like helping really well. So I asked her, like, where can I go from here? So she was like, the first thing is I have to register you with HSE. So she did that. So I have to tell you, like, I've never got money, but I've got the amazing love in the world that people look for. And
so you cannot be paid for the work that you're doing here?
No, I can't be paid for the work I'm doing here. And I'm so happy to do that. Like, now we have paid employees and we have also volunteers. But, you know, like, I'm just happy that I can be able to come out and create all these things and being able to bring revenue to the project. And these people go happy home who are on employed contracts. And for those who are volunteering, they're able to get transport to go back home and come the next morning. But then while we've been here, I have to be honest with you, we've opened doors that we are going to become non-stoppable. This is our little secret, but we are going to be like one of the biggest supplier in one of the biggest institutions in Ireland, and it's confirmed, it's sealed. So, give me a five.
And that's the Leap of Faith for this Good Friday. We'll be back next Friday at our usual time of 10 o'clock. From all of us here, goodbye.